Hello and welcome to another instalment of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham and we will be dining at the top table once more in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right, we made hard work of it, but alas, the Albion has secured top flight status for another year and our point against Newcastle made it impossible to be caught. The game itself, though, well, that was the deadest of dead rubbers, the nillest of nil-nils, and even the most talented of Hollywood scriptwriters would struggle to make anything exciting out of this one. But the job was done, and we go into this weekend's final game of the season at Burnley with nothing to worry about. In other news, we say goodbye to two of the good guys, as Ezequiel Scolotto and Beren Kael are packing their bags and they're heading for pastures new. But will anyone else be heading for the exit door? Joining me today to discuss this and more is, of course, Alan Wares. And we're delighted to welcome back a man who's left a few clubs in his time, but he's always been welcome back. It's Adam Virgo. Good evening, Chaps.
Hello, Adam. Good to see you. Are you well?
I'm fine. Is that nightclubs or football clubs you were talking about? I was asked to leave.
You tell us.
A bit of both, probably.
How many nightclubs have you been asked to leave?
Oh, AD. This isn't the news of the world. All I would say is, and we've had this discussion before, AD, especially when we're sitting up in the press room at Vicarage Road, is that is the one football ground anywhere I've ever been to, probably because the amount of black paint it is that there's there. It's the one place that looks most like a nightclub.
Yeah, although Anfield looked pretty much like a nightclub this week with their trophy presentation, but we'll come to that a little bit later on.
Yeah, Adam, how have you been?
Me, I've been fine. Lockdown has been interesting. I spoke to AD last week, and homeschooling was difficult and challenging. Probably like every person who's got a child listening to this podcast will probably. Mm-hmm. Associated. I thought it was just my children, but then the more I speak to, it's everybody. So I felt a lot better after speaking to people. But you know, it was just nice to see the Premier League get finished. It was nice to see the League One, League Two playoffs get done. The National League playoffs be finished as well. So it was good to see that many of the leagues were finished in a roundabout way in terms of points per game or.
Adam. I mean, we've been asking this to all of the guests we've had on since the restart, and so we're going to ask you as well. I mean, do you think it was the right decision to restart, or do you think it was just a case of the moneymaker?
I think it's a bit of both. I think it shows that football is a business, and you need to try and get across the line. The sponsorship deals that the Premier League would have had to pay back for, the TV rights the Premier League would have had to pay back for, the teams I'm talking about. But I said before, and I've done a couple of interviews about this, if you called that season null and void, you'll be rewarding the sides near the bottom of the league in terms of the teams that have played poorly this season and the teams that were bound for relegation to get another slice of the pie. And then the teams that were being promoted, i.e. Leeds and West Brom, as we've seen, they wouldn't get that opportunity. So I think the only logical way that the season could have been finished was by the points per game thing. It gives Liverpool, I mean, imagine Liverpool not winning the league this year. It would have been, you know, an absolute catastrophe. So I think in a roundabout way, the season to be finished, I think it was the only way that the Premier League and the Football League could have finished. So I think it was the right thing to do, providing all the safety aspects were covered, which it seems like in terms of the players being tested. I mean, I do MLS on Sky, and you know, Nashville and Dallas have pulled out because so many of their players have got COVID-19. So America's on a different situation. So it shows the testing procedure of the Premier League, how instructive it's been, that players have managed to get through this unharmed.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, Aidy, can I cut across you there, mate? In that case, I'm going to ask this. I mean, sorry, to raise this point that, you know, obviously you had your career cut short, unfortunately, through a nasty injury. But, you know, if things had gone normally, if in the great scheme of things, it's probably just about now that you'd have probably sort of been looking to close on your career. You know, you're 37, you're only a few months older than Glenn Murray, who seemed to go on forever, and so on. Yeah. My point is that it's a hypothetical one, but if you had still been playing, supposing this was your last season, how would you have felt about how restart and all the testing and everything that was eventually put in place, assuming that you were playing in the Premier League, how would you have felt about how it would have been affecting you personally? Can you put yourself in the mind of a current Premier League footballer or an Albion footballer?
Yeah, I think it can be slightly difficult because you just won't get that one opportunity to say thank you to the fans, or you know that walk around the pitch that you do after the game. The players do with their family, that actually means a lot to them, just to actually say thank you to the paying customer, that the support that you've given throughout the year has always been greatly appreciated. Win, lose or draw, players will show frustration sometimes and walk off, and there'll be other players that will kind of clap the fans, win, lose or draw. But I think as a squad as a whole, it just gives you that opportunity. And if you've been at the club for a long time, someone like David Silva, for instance, who's not going to get that chance now to say goodbye to his fans, it can be difficult. But I promise you now, there's people suffering a lot worse financially. There's people suffering a lot worse in health conditions through this virus. So I think you always have to put things into perspective slightly in terms of the situation you are in. Listen, it is unheard of. Hopefully we'll never go through this again. But I think the players have done very, very well. It's not easy not playing in front, you know, it's not easy playing in front of empty stadiums, especially when you're fighting relegation, especially when you need your 12th person to be the crowd to get you through those situations. So as a player, I think at my age, if I'm talking as a 37-year-old, I'd probably look at the bigger picture. But as a 20-year-old, you may see it slightly differently. But listen, there's worse things in life that can happen to you, and there's probably people going through a lot worse than what a player saying goodbye to the crowd is. So that's probably the way I'd have probably looked at it today.
Okay then, Adam, just to put a slightly different twist on that then. Now, obviously, I mean, you mentioned the lower leagues, the national leagues, leagues one and two, which didn't get to complete their seasons, although the playoffs are still ongoing with those. I mean, as a player for those who the clubs that rely on the click of the turnstile, the flip of the burger, as it will, to generate the income to play the players. I mean, for those players, that must be particularly difficult, particularly because they've all got mortgages and like everyone else.
Yeah, I think the everyday football fan, I think the majority of them now understand that League One, League Two, and National League players especially would have suffered through this pandemic financially. The clubs would have certainly suffered big time through this situation. I think fans forget sometimes that the TV rights of the Football League and BT for the National League, for instance, doesn't pay for your finances through the season. What pays for your finances is what the turnstiles, as you mentioned there, the season tickets, the hospitality. That's absolutely massive in terms of the turnover. And if you're not getting crowds through there, it's going to have a massive, massive effect on the teams in these situations. And, you know, we've seen Wigan go through a difficult spot at the moment. I think when this is all over and things have settled down, you may see other clubs come out financially in hard situations. But I'll give credit to League One, League Two and National League, and North and South of National League, which I cover as well, that a non-league side to raise £50,000-£60,000 to provide testing and hotels and travel fees, I think shows a testament to the behind the scenes of football, of what's being provided. You know, you look at the Premier League, those players can survive for a year, 2 years without even earning a penny ever again. But I think it shows how strong the Football League is and non-league football is in England. And I think that's why the Premier League is regarded as the best league in the world. But in terms of from top to bottom, England can't be beat in any way, stretch or form.
I mean, going forward for that, though, Adam.
Sorry, I want to come in because it's absolutely right. I mean, the team that I'm thinking of here, and we haven't really talked that far down the divisions, and I personally think that they were screwed over, considering that the season they've been having, is with Virgs's old mucker, is Adam Hinshelwood at Worthing. Top of the table when the whole thing crashed and burned. And you realise, your point is absolutely right, AD, about the click of the turnstile and the flip of the burger to help them, you know, the money sort of go around. But I'm just wondering, with hindsight, were they a bit quick to abandon the leagues? you know, even though we've got major sort of misgivings about, you know, you and I, Ed, you've got major misgivings about the football starting up again. Could they have actually, I mean, I'm throwing it out there, could they have actually waited a little bit to just to see what they could have done? Or is it the fact that they are so reliant on the fans? Because at the end of the day, whether the football's on or whether the football's behind closed doors, they're not going to get any money in. But could they have completed their season? And this is what I find so frustrating on behalf of Worthing, for instance. I'll throw that to you, AD, actually, because obviously we go there quite a bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's frustrating, but I mean, it was the right decision. I mean, they decided to do it across the board. I mean, the fact that the league did it without really too much consultation with the clubs, they just said there's a pandemic going on. We're gonna stop playing now. We're just gonna call it quits. I mean, it's difficult because they're three quarters of the way through the season. Worthing was sitting 7 points clear at the top of the league and looking set for promotion, which is something we've been aiming at for a long time. But you know, I mean, it's the bottom line is it's the safety. Like, if they can't guarantee the safety of the players or the supporters or the match day staff, then it's absolutely the right decision to do so. But you know, that decision could have been from the Premier League right across all of the leagues. And to be honest, from a health point of view, for the safety of the players and supporters, everything else, that's pretty. I don't think anyone could have batted too much of an eye at this if that was to be the case. But they have completed the season. We've got one more game to go for the Albion. And unfortunately, we don't have to worry too much about it, although obviously we want to. It's a game that we'll want to win. But let's move on from there for a little bit. I'm sure we'll touch on other subjects in regards to lockdown later on. But we have to at least play lip service to the events at the Amex on Monday evening.
You had a whale of a time, didn't you, AD?
It was just so weird. I mean, the audible, the noise of the crowd, of the gathered press pack there, when Adam Webster shot, and they suddenly realised, hang on, if that goes in, we're going to have to completely rewrite our copy. It was like it was the sound of like 300 people literally waking up. Going, something's actually happening.
What you're saying here is that whether that was a full house or behind closed doors, the sound would have been exactly the same across the stadium.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, well, although there was other chances later on, but I mean, we'll talk about some of that in a minute. But Adam, I mean, you've played in these games at the end of the season where. You know, no one's got anything to play for. I mean,
Dinger didn't.
Well, he's played.
I remember I want to say the 2002 season. We had a rearranged game at Halifax, which got called off about 18 times.
Played in on League Thursday, night, wasn't it? In the end,
and we played on the Thursday, and then we had Shrewsbury away on the Saturday, and I. Probably the first time ever, I think 9 out of the 11 players were hungover from probably a week's worth of drink. I think we lost the game 3-0.
I'll tell you what this is, Vergs. This is 2 days after that Chesterfield game. Because, yeah, it was everything had to finish on that last day of the season. So we had Chesterfield, which was concertina into the Tuesday. They moaned because they were banging on about their points deduction. Then we had to squeeze Halifax in, and that's what I think you're talking about.
That's right. Yeah.
Everyone was wasted. And then Saturday, everyone was wasted for the Shrewsbury game as well.
Yeah, and it was boiling hot as well.
Yep.
I mean, it's been boiling hot.
How wasted were you?
I was a young nipper then. I was scared of Mickey Adams. Even if I had a coach.
You were scared of everyone. I mean,
even if I had a Coke, Mickey would be looking at the sugar content that I was drinking and stuff. And Mickey would always be like one of those, if you want a drink, you can have a drink. But for the likes of Danny, Charlie and all the senior pros, they could have what they want. But as a youngster, that you just know he's got like the prying eye over you. So, I was a good boy back then.
Okay, well, back to my original question there. So, I mean, you've played in these games at the end of the season where there's anything riding on them. And I mean, is it hard to get motivated for those games? Yeah. Or I mean, does it, like, you know, at the end of the day, for each place further up the league you finish, it's extra money in the coffers, particularly at this time where money isn't necessarily coming into the clubs. I mean, it would have been would have been nice to actually get a result. But I mean, playing in those games, how does it feel?
Yeah, it's not easier. I mean, AD, I mean, you talk about the Brighton players and you talk about what I did when I was, you'd already won the league and you're going for it. I mean, Liverpool are the best example of that in terms of their results after they'd actually won the league was very difficult. I think they were all, someone will probably pick me up on this. I think they were close to being the side that had won the league that then didn't win the most points afterwards, where that momentum that you try your absolute best to get to a certain level of, i.e. winning the league, being in the Europa League, qualifying for the Champions League, or surviving relegation, the euphoria and the emotion of the ups and downs that you go through, and that break that the players have had at the same time to get yourself up for games after that. A fan may not understand, but it's almost like when you've worked so hard to find something and get something, and then all of a sudden you've got it, you will have a couple of weeks afterwards where you just maybe take your foot off the pedal and just sort of just go through the motions a little bit. I mean, listen, it's not the fact of not trying, but you could just clearly tell in that the last game as well, it was almost like testimonial pace, really. It wasn't probably the first time in a while.
Let me talk you through Adam's career at Withdean, certainly in the first time round. So we're talking about 01. We won the championship, the fourth division, against Chesterfield, and there was two games to go and everyone had got wasted and they probably can't remember the rest of that week. Okay, fair enough.
I think we drew one, lost one after that, yeah.
It was that, yeah. Drew 0-0 at Halifax and lost
at
Shrewsbury. Okay, 0-2. We were, again, we won the third division this time under Peter Taylor, but we kept going to the last on account of the fact that Reading was still chasing us, and we got the championship, I think, confirmed last home game of the season, which was against Swindon. Then we had a game against Port Vale away. So that's 0-2. So again, you're not really going to take your foot off the gas necessarily. 0-3, no. Massive relegation scrap, and we get relegated at Grimsby. 0-4, we crack on, and we're in the playoffs. So there's no let up there. 0-5, another relegation game, including the famous one against Ipswich, which you
scored
and helped the other side a little bit. 0-6, had you gone to...
You two are the only two that keep reminding me of that. Everyone else gives me the benefit of the goal.
And then there was...
it's our civic duty, Adam.
Were you still with us for the 0-6? Well, we did actually get relegated. I lose track.
Yeah, no, that's the reason why they got relegated.
Oh, yeah.
I've gone.
You've gone, yeah.
But then I came back and we almost got relegated.
Yeah. So your point about asking Adam till the end what it's like to sort of like, you know, to be on the beach at the end of the season. If you're talking about his Withdean career, he wouldn't have a clue.
Don't forget, he used to play for Celtic and
we won the league a few
Colchester
games before.
And Yeovil and all sorts of other teams where this would have happened. So, but I mean, obviously the stadium was empty on Monday. I mean, do you think if you are going into the game as a player feeling not quite up for it, for want of a better phrase, and do you think that having a crowd in there would have made a little bit of a difference to push you over the edge?
I think so. I think it does make that small bit of difference. Listen, I don't think any player goes onto that pitch not to try. That's not what I'm saying. I just think it's... You just slightly drop off the pace slightly. And it's almost like you look at Newcastle and it's almost like, well, if we play like this, you play like this. And I mean, Andy Carroll could have scored at the end maybe. But it was just one of those games where you'll see, I mean, it'd be interesting to see how Brighton do against Burnley. There'll be other games on the weekend, you know, on the Sunday where that I don't think they'll make the match of the day highlights too long. Do you know what I mean? So,
This was definitely a game that's destined to be last in the match of the day. But I mean, I've got to give some credit to Newcastle. I mean, their shape was it was a regimented two, like packs of four, and they were basically saying, "All right, then come and break us down." And like none of our creative players could actually come up with anything. And there's no one trying to overlap apart from Lamptey, who tried to get through a couple of times. And no one was playing that ball through to try and to break those lines and make them move, but it just nullified each other basically.
But I've never seen a team, certainly not in the Premier League, come to Brighton, come to the Amex, and try and be so unadventurous. I mean, they came out their shells in the last 20 minutes or so, but you know, and are hoping to hit us on the break. A sort of thing that hopefully, I think that for the most part, apart from against the really top teams, something we've actually learned our lesson on. But yeah, I thought Newcastle came down here and really, yeah, had sort of almost shaken hands at 0-0, you know, for 0-0 before the kickoff. And I find that sort of really disappointing. And I'd hope that Graham Potter won't do that against Burnley. Now, it's possible, and I know we're going to talk about sort of people who we're going to say goodbye to later in the show, but I'm just wondering, because effectively Burnley against Brighton is a dead rubber, whether either A, there'll be some new talent introduced into the team on that game, and or those who we are releasing at the end of the season will get their swan song. I don't know.
Yeah. Perhaps. Well, I mean, one standout point that from the Newcastle game was the bench. And there was a first appearance for young Alex Cochrane on the bench there. Obviously, he didn't get on. But, I mean, that was certainly something to remember for him. First match day squad in the Premier League. So he's not a player which I know an awful lot about, so I can't really comment too much about, apart from that he's a defender. But
I did used to watch the under-23s when they were on, when the club used to, last season, certainly when Premier League 2, when Aaron Connolly turned up a new sheet for them, and he was the player of the season. Now, I saw a lot of those players, and Cochrane looked actually very, very assured. And again, another part of the machine that is now finally being put together at Lancing.
Yeah, we're good at producing defenders, though, aren't we, Adam?
Yeah, Tommy Elphick, Steve Cook, yeah, they're great players.
Yeah, in your case...
Hang on, are you calling yourself a striker now?
Yeah.
I'm versatile. Versatile. No, but you're right, yeah. We always prefer it. The defenders have always been, you know, I think a feature of Brighton. I think if you look over the years and going back to Steve Foster, Mark Lawrenson, Danny Cullip, Guy Butters, Duffy, you know, we've always seemed to produce decent defenders.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of those, obviously, they were imports. But, I mean, people like yourself, like Dunkey, like Tommy.
Yeah.
And you know, these are the people for whom Brighton means a lot, playing for your hometown club. You know, it's massive, and it's and long may that continue.
Well, even the likes of Adam Hinshelwood scoring spectacular own goals. You know, if you're going to do something, do it spectacularly.
Well, there is that. Okay, well, I mean, there's not really an awful lot to talk about with the Newcastle game, so we won't. So you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show is brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, as ever, an online glossary of over 110,000 shirts.
Gallery, not glossary.
Well, all right, that is the correct term. I'll be correct on that one. But go there and have a look at the gallery and see this particular monstrosity which Verbs is going to describe for us.
I can see this shirt, something AD would wear on a Saturday night. it's slightly flamboyant. It's kind of got like black shoulders with it looks like a house kind of involved in it in terms of the shape. It's got a sponsor down in the middle, E-CL, and then it's got almost like a fish, it looks like, at the bottom.
It actually looks like a 2020 shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, something, yeah, that's a great shout.
It looks revolting. It looks like a Formula One shirt.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know about that. It looks like something that, like, somewhere in the IPL would wear. But
basically, it looks like there's that silhouette, that red silhouette you're talking about, looks like AD prancing around in front of a barn with a mountain thing behind it. As for the badge, it's kind of a shield with a football on the top of it.
Yeah, it reminds me of a Malaga badge.
Is it Malaga? I mean, I'm pretty certain it is well, it's a Hispanic club because that's all Spanish writing on it. Mm-hmm. Corpesca SA would be... and it's got Operada por BHP Billiton. As for who that could be, I mean, Adam, what we have here is that AD loves thinking that it's going to be Spain, but it could be anywhere in South... Well, apart from Brazil, anywhere in South America, because he loves playing around with us like that. So, guns ahead then, Adam, with something as revolting as this. Are you going to guess which club this is?
I think I'll go with Spanish. I'll say someone like Sporting Gijón or someone like that.
No, it is not.
I'm going to guess, AD, that it's someone up in the Andes because of the mountain thing.
Not a bad shout, actually. That's a very good shout. But this is what Phil from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this particular minger. Basically, yeah, go on, then. He says, I was going to give you an easy one. Then I found this total disaster for a shirt. So this is what you got. This is the 2015-2016 away shirt of Chilean side Municipal Mejones. They play in the Chilean Segunda Division, which is the third level of football in Chile. And the side goes by a number of nicknames. They are Los del Megapuerto, which means the boys from the Megaport. Los Bombarderos del Pacifico, which translates to be the Pacific Bombers. And La Furia Celeste, the Celestial Fury. None of them are particularly catchy, but there you go. They play at the Estadio Municipal de Mejoles, which has a capacity of 1,500 in the Megaport community of the Mejones, which is in the north of Chile. The club has just played their first season in the Segunda Division, having started out in the Tercera Division after being formed in 2005. No link to the UK or the Albion. Their entire squad is Chilean. I don't think they've ever won anything. So I don't think they have any famous players. One thing I do know, though, is their home colours are traditionally blue and white stripes.
Of course they are.
A load more of those at oldfootballshirts.com. So thanks for that, Phil.
Well, when you get to see that shirt up on Facebook, of course it's perfectly natural that the home team's going to be blue and white stripes. When you see this abomination, all I can ever see, now I've seen this shirt, AD, is you prancing around like a fairy in front of a barn. It's pretty horrific. I mean, what kind of, also, it's raising the point that Adam made earlier about how football is supported down the leagues. A Chilean club in their second division, I think you said.
Third division.
Yeah, Segunda Division. And their crowd...
Oh, second, yeah.
Yeah. And their stadium's 1,500 people.
1,500.
Yeah, that's pitiful. I know Chile's not a particularly... I suppose probably where they are is actually fairly remote, but even so, 1,500 in the second division.
Yeah.
That's worse than we had at with Dean.
Well, only for a JPT game, yeah, for sure.
Well, there is. But,
okay, well, let's move it on then. Adam, we've just coming to the end of the season, obviously, final game of the season this Sunday at Burnley. It's been the first season under Graham Potter. What is your end-of-term report?
I think it's been okay. I think there's been positives and I think there's been a lot of negatives as well. I think listening to Graham's interview after the Newcastle game, I don't think he wanted to say it, but he kind of said it in terms of change of manager, change of philosophy, change of style of play from what the club had been used to for a couple of years. Was he coming to bring in more attacking football? Yes, and he's done that. Has he come in to bring in youngsters? Yes, he's done that. But I think he's sometimes asking players to play in a certain way. As we found out against Liverpool, that playing out from the back is still an issue, that we can get caught sometimes and we maybe not have the players that are comfortable on the ball to play the ball out from the back. But again, you look at last season, we stayed up on the second to last game of the season. So we're in exactly the same spot as we were last year in terms of staying in the league, despite playing probably better football. But don't forget, we still went for a massive barren spell where we weren't winning games of football. And I've been saying it for a couple of years now in terms of where Brighton are at. The recruitment is absolutely vital now. Are we still going to go down the road of unknown players in mediocre leagues coming into the Premier League and involving this squad? Or are we going to go slightly less down the road in terms of signing in bulk and maybe signing two or three players that the fans' head turn and says, you know what? This player is going to improve our squad. This player is going to get us up the league into the top 10, because that's where Brighton look at next. Don't look at Europa League or anywhere further. Can we get up the league into that top 10? And to me, that comes down to recruitment. And I don't think we've signed a player that I've looked at and thought, this is the one who's going to change it for us. You know, Trossard's come in and people think, okay, he's done okay in his respective league. Lacardia was another one that people looked at but didn't really know too much about. But I think Brighton maybe need to be slightly braver in signing recognised players that have done it in Spain and in Italy and in France in the top league to take the club forward onto that next level.
OK, so what, gun to head, what do you think we actually need?
I still think we need another striker. I still think that... But Graham's gone this year in terms of Connolly and Mope more than Glenn. And I think, I don't know in terms of a target man is Graham's forte. I think he'd rather pack the midfield with quicker players to play on the counter-attack. I think a left-back is an issue, I generally think, as well as Dan Burn's done. And I think a lot of Peter fans have said he could be in for player of the year in terms of his performances. But I've played out of position, and you do as well as you can, and there's a certain level that you get to. But then you just know when that quality left-back comes in with a quality left foot that gets up and down, then that's certainly an area that Brighton need to move into. And I think as well, I think we need a better midfielder that can maybe get us 8 to 10 goals a season. I think that's the area as well, in that midfield area. To maybe get us more goals. And I don't know why, but I mean, you two have followed the Albion a lot more than I have in terms of personnel, but I can't remember an Albion midfielder getting 10 goals in a season. You may be able to follow me up on that. In terms of
Anthony Knockhart?
Yeah, but he's more on the left-hand. He's more of a winger attacking player. I'm talking about a
Danny
central
Wilson.
Midfielder. Who?
Danny Wilson.
Yeah, and that, yeah, that's going back and that's 5 years ago.
That's when you had hair. Chippy? Yeah, maybe Chippy. But I don't know if he got 10 goals a season.
I don't think he did. No, I mean, I think if you're talking literally from midfield, then you are probably talking off the top of my head. I mean, you know, when we got promoted, we had Leon Knight and Bobby Zamora. So for 3 seasons, we had, you know, players who could, you know, who got near 30 goals. And then the next one would be on the sort of like, you know, 9 or 10. I'm just trying to think, when we got promoted, we had Glenn score 20, Ashley Barnes got 20 in that same season, and then we got promoted to the Premier League. We had Baldock and Murray. Like you say, you're right about Knockhart, but as a creative midfield player, or that box-to-box engine, or that leader, that whatever
Gross,
it is.
Yeah, I think Gross was close to getting it a couple of years ago, but he's not been the same player since his first season, you know what I mean? So,
The point I'd make about this, and it's kind of carrying on from your point though, Adam, is that you're right. We do need those midfielders to start chipping in as well. But I think that it's something we notice more because we're frustrated when we don't score. But I've noticed that, you know, so many clubs are like it is actually the nature of finishing. You know, even with we were playing Liverpool and Man United, they could have stuck 6 past us and some of their finishing was woeful. We know that we've looked at our team this season and at times the finishing has been woeful. We had Paul Hayward on last week saying that Neil Mope needs to be more composed in front of goal. But I think you've also got to argue that everyone needs to be more composed in front of goal, because just about every midfielder's shot, right, or so many strikers' shots that you see coming in end up in Rose Ed. That's
a classic example would have been Eva Suma at Southampton last week, where he had an absolutely wonderful chance late on. I can see what he is trying to do, but I mean, he didn't even hit the target in the end of the day. So, but I think there's definitely goals in Eve, and I think next season we're going to see a lot more from him.
I think in terms of Graham, I think we're creating more chances, but I don't know if we've got the quality of player to take those chances. And that's what we're talking about, maybe. Going into, you know, Paco Alcacer was a player that was at Dortmund that went to Villarreal for 17 million, Spanish international. He'd scored 17 goals the previous season at Dortmund. They had to move him on to bring in Haaland from Salzburg. Someone like that, who's a recognised Spanish international, he's gone to Villarreal. Could Brighton not be competitive to go for? They paid 16.5-17 million for him, the same they paid for Lacazette, Johan Bash, and those players. But that's a recognised striker for me.
But does coming to the Premier League automatically not put another 20% on just for the sheer hell of it?
Yeah, that's a great point as well. And I always know that Brighton may be sceptical of being put into that, you know, being pushed into the wrong direction in terms of finances. And as you mentioned, an extra 10 million is going to be put onto a player that's coming to the Premier League because they know the money is there.
Yeah.
And you've also got to look at the style of play as well. You were talking about Glenn there but just before the lockdown, Glenn was starting a lot of the games and he was doing all right. I mean, his performance at West Ham, for instance, was absolutely brilliant. But to get the most out of Glenn, you need to play in a different way. And the setup of the team is way too narrow. The wingers aren't getting wide and putting crosses into the box, which is what Glenn thrives on. I mean, he is a six-yard box poacher as well. And if the ball's in and around the area, he will get you the goals. But we're not necessarily playing that way. It tends to be very narrow. Tends to be everything coming through the middle, and to play that way, as Al correctly said, you need to get those shots on target. You need to work the goalkeeper. And we've been saying this all season. We've just left way too many points out on the pitch through woeful finishing.
But therein lies your point, AD, isn't it? Is what we do create the chances. The play is better. You know, there's times when we've absolutely bossed certain games. All right, we were 2-0 down against Liverpool, but the game wasn't over after 10 minutes. And for the rest of that game, we gave them a game. And you could argue we were the better side. But the point is that the nature of the play, when it works, and it's not always the case, but when it works, some of it can be scintillating. But the issue that we're saying is that, like I say, chances are created, and we're not putting them away. Mm. Something's going right. Bearing in mind that to create a chance requires a team, to finish it requires the individual.
Mm.
It's the individual, it's that moment, that snatch chance, it's that composed chance. The other thing I was going to say is that when you're talking about Glenn Murray, now, he's the old war horse, he is the sort of like the wise head on the sort of like, the old shoulders. And I still believe he has a purpose to fulfill. One, as a sneaky sort of teacher to teach the tricks and trade of the trade to the likes of Connolly and Mopai and whoever comes in. But two, he is an option that should Graham Potter decide that he does want to play the target man, and he has done that this season. Should he want to do it? I mean, we did it against Southampton. It worked to a certain point, and then they sort of changed it around, and it didn't work after that, certainly in the second half. I think it's important that an option is there left within the squad on the bench that a target man, as ugly as it can be, is utilised now and again.
I mean, Glenn is still under contract for another year anyway, so it's just a case of whether he wants it. I mean, at his age, he wants to be playing week in, week out, probably. I mean, Adam, quite well. I mean, what do you reckon?
Listen, I think he's happy where he is. I think there comes a contentment in your life where going out on loan to somewhere up north or in the Midlands is not really his style of forte. I think when you look at Glenn now, I think the club have to work about maybe periods of the game where he can influence. So are we going to go for Mopay and Connolly, whoever we bring in and play on the counter-attack? But Glenn's the option with 20 minutes to go, or like you did at Southampton, like you did at West Ham, because there was a period where Glenn wasn't involved at all and Graham still wasn't getting those results. And in the end, he went back to Glenn. Glenn got a double at West Ham, as you mentioned there, or maybe got one, I might be wrong, sorry. Yeah. And he played really, really well. But it almost seems since the lockdown's come back, he's almost looked at fitness in terms of players playing on the counter-attack rather than Glenn standing still and bringing players into play, because that's sometimes easier to mark against. So I still think Glenn's got a massive part to play, because like a cult hero. There's a lot he's done for the club, and there'll be periods of the game where you just need a little bit of experience, and Glenn can certainly provide. There's no point going to buy another experienced player to replace Glenn. That's not the point. It's more, I think he will have a prevalent part, and I think from what I'm hearing next season is that they may be using the five substitutes and having more subs on the bench.
That's the point I was going to make. I mean, what do you think of the five? I mean, the five substitute thing. Obviously, it's been brought in with the coronavirus in mind and players' fitness coming back into it. But I mean, we're back up to speed. Pretty much all the players should be fully match fit by now. So I believe is still the only manager to use all five substitutes in every game.
I don't think it's every game. Not now.
Yeah, I think it was the right call to do. I think it was a change in terms of the players' fitness, having that amount of time off. And, players need a proper pre-season in terms of fixtures and friendlies to get back to match fitness. But I think moving on to next season, you know, we still need to go back to the three because it's been fine for many, many years. And if this virus hadn't come along, they wouldn't have changed it next season anyway. So whether or not it changes in a few years' time when they can maybe bring more money into the Premier League and they can have a bigger squad, etc. Yeah. But I just don't see changing the three-man substitute to five.
Well, it's like having the drinks break as well. I mean,
that's not happened.
Well, no, I mean, that's just going to... I mean, Virgs, I mean, you do a lot of commentary for the MLS, and it's like, you know, the drinks break is just... They're going to try and probably bring that in as a chance to bring more in advertising revenue from TV.
Yeah, MLS will... Yeah, they will do that, and they're throwing an advert for 30 seconds, which will accumulate X amount of pounds. I know the Super Bowl advert is ridiculously expensive. I know MLS is slightly different, but you're right, they're advertising... For companies is huge in the MLS. I can understand the drinks break to start with, but I think this should be set up that the managers have to stay on the bench and not be able to put a message across because at the end of the day now, it's become tactical, which that's not the integrity of what that drinks break before. The drinks break was to get players fluid, to prevent injury, and for them to go back out for another period of game. But again, you won't see that next season.
Moving it seems back like to, it's to give simple minds a few quid as well, judging by what they're playing every time they have it.
Just a quick one, getting back to the point about Glenn Murray and how much he's going to play. And you know, never mind all the subs and the three and the five and what have you and what have you. From the sentimental point of view, bearing in mind we could do this for Bruno, I think it would be an absolute tragedy that if we said our farewells to Glenn from an empty stadium in a game that was sort of almost a dead rubber, that was probably one of the worst tedious games that we've seen at the stadium. I mean, that's not much of a sign-off for someone who is who's the highest post-war goal scorer.
We said exactly the same thing about David Silva earlier. I mean, it's we're in these empty stadiums and that's what there is obviously
time. We have the option of Glenn for next season, and like I say, I think myself and Adam, maybe you are as well, but I think that he has a role to fulfil, even if it's not necessarily being as effective as he has or can be from the bench. The only other thing I'd have said is that he probably would have gone on to be the club's all-time leading scorer if we'd have got relegated, because he knows how to bang them in the Championship. But yeah. I get the feeling that Tommy Cooper is going to be safe.
So I mean, the straw poll here is obviously we want Glenn to stick around and be an important cog in the machine next season. But we said goodbye to two... bit part players. I mean, Baron Kaya hasn't played at all for us this year, so it's not exactly a surprise that we're saying goodbye to him. But 131 appearance for the Albion, scoring 5 goals. He was an important player for us.
5 goals? Is that all?
Yeah, that's all he scored for us. Yeah. Most of them in cup.
Well, there's that reiterates Adam Virgo's line there. I mean, he was player of the season, and his entire time with us, he scored 5. I genuinely didn't realise it was as few as that. He was obviously a key element, certainly in the missed out promotion season, where he got player of the season from the fans. An excellent sort of midfield player, probably one of the best ones that we've had, certainly in the past 20 years. Couldn't quite sort of make the leap up, even though obviously he'd done very well at Celtic. But, you know, his name will forever be etched into the memories of the Albion fans. I don't think he was quite quite as prevalent in the actual promotion season itself. I think the main midfield pair was Stevens and Sidwell, but Kyle, he was so vital, so pivotal in the raising of the quality of the team under Houghton.
Yeah, not too many players have played for Brighton and Celtic, though, well.
I can't think of any more, actually.
Can you, Vic?
No.
What's your take on Baron Kaya? I mean, how was he considered at Celtic as well, for that matter?
I agree with you, Alan. I think he was a player that came into the club at a difficult time. I want to say Garcia brought him in. I might be wrong with that one.
Not sure.
But when he came in, I thought his intelligence on the ball was better than what we had. Mm-hmm. And I think he just raised that tempo. I just maybe think the change of manager and Chris coming in, going with Stevens and Sidwell, two solid centre midfielders that don't really get forward very much, maybe affected him in terms of the regular football. But I completely agree with you. I remember when he first came in, it was, I think it was one of the first years I'd started commentating. I was doing a lot on BBC Sussex and, you know, he was a massive difference. I think he scored one or two important goals. Yeah, he scored some important goals to keep the club in the league at the time.
3-2 against Forest, I think it was.
Yeah, he was just a quality in his own in terms of on the ball. Maybe could have played a few more games, but I know he had a few injuries as well along the way. But I agree with Al. I think his impact when he came in was to raise the standard of players on the ball. And I think he outshone that midfield at that time. And I think the fans will remember him in good stead rather than...
I've been on record.
I've got a record.
I absolutely loved him.
Salivating tribute. Go on, AD. Off you go.
Well, I think he could have, if he was given an opportunity at this level, I think he would have been okay. I mean, you don't play as well as he did for Celtic against Barcelona and not be a bad player. And injuries caught up with him. I think he was struggling. I don't think he got much game time at Charlton either, and he got another injury there. I mean, at the end of the day, he's a player that I've greatly enjoyed watching. I mean, I love a swashbuckling midfielder with a great engine like he had. I'm sorry to see him go. So the time is right for him to seek a new challenge. I wish him well.
He's still only 32. He's still got at least 3 or 4 years left in him.
I still remember like one of his when he first signed for us. He tweeted something out. He's like, he said, "Is there anywhere you can get decent hummus in Brighton?"
Yes, he was moaning about that, wasn't
it? I remember that. Maybe laugh. Anyway,
it's too obvious, AD, that he's actually going to end up possibly following. And at the time of recording this, we don't know, it hasn't been confirmed. That assuming it does happen, that he could follow Chris Hughton to Bristol City.
I would not be surprised.
Yeah, good shout.
He would be. I suspect he wouldn't be alone, actually. Which is bring. I mean, we're just quickly talk about Galgo as well, because we're saying goodbye to Ezequiel Scalotto as well. Didn't really work out for us. I mean, he again a swashbuckling player.
The swashbuckling bit was his hair, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, he was very good at running in straight lines, but he would not going past people too much. But you know, I mean, he's gone down in folklore. I mean, the way he wound up Wilf Sahar against Palace earlier in the season, where he got poleaxed completely against Arsenal. We went down looking like Jesus, which was entertaining. But I mean, again, we wish him well. But I suspect those two were not going to be the only two heading for the exit. One player which I think would follow Chris Hughton if he does get a gig at Bristol City would be Solly March.
What makes you think Solly March is going?
I don't see a future for him here at the moment. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but I mean, Adam, we're going to talk about your new gig as an agent in a minute, but for Solly, I think the right thing for his career now would be to move, because he's not a wing back. He's a flying winger who on his day is absolutely unplayable, but he's been played out of position. He's been playing on the wrong. He often gets played on the wrong side of the pitch, and we know that there's an absolutely outstanding player there, but we've just not seen it for a long time.
Yeah, I think he's just been inconsistent. I think there were times when I first commented. I remember him scoring a pre-season goal against Norwich, and he coming off the line and he scored a spectacular goal. And I think Solly's always been about confidence, and there's always been. He's one of those players, I think, an Albion fan, just kind of want to shake sometimes to say, come on, you know, you can do better than what you're doing. And I think sometimes there are players that just kind of almost become into a rot a little bit, to say it like that, that maybe a change of direction, a change of manager and a change of club would be better for him in terms of his progression forward. And I think he's one of those players that... I think if the club want to move forward, sentiment aside, he will certainly have to move on, because there's better players out there than him at the moment.
The last two or three years, certainly the last couple of years, when we've said, certainly pre-season or close season, we've said, this is the time for Solly to step up. Can he step up? And we hear all these things from, especially from the likes of Glenn Murray, who is there to service. It's you know, he does things in training that, you know, he's not seen before. He can ghost past people. He's fantastic. He's brilliant and what have you. But on the pitch, when it comes to it, when at the time that we're all seeing it, there's times when he's been brilliant, and we can think of that time where he almost single-handedly saved the FA Cup match against Millwall. And there's times when he has been brilliant. The time he came on against Birmingham City and ran them ragged. But that's too far in between. You know, that's not often enough. We saw him against Newcastle. All right, no one played brilliantly, but he just didn't offer it. And I think, like I said, I think he's got as far as he can because I don't know. It's almost like it's a self-imposed glass ceiling he's given himself. We know there's better there, and it's just not coming, and it's going to be one of those things that we're going to look back on in a few years' time and think, Solly March, great player, how frustrating was he?
He's a Theo Walcott.
Yeah.
I think that's what he is in terms of, you're looking at a player to describe him as potential, but just never quite did it.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, but sometimes as a player, you just have to press the reset button, right?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a change.
Absolutely. And we're going to work on the assumption that Chris Hughton is going to Bristol City. I can see him ram raiding half the Albion's treasure chest for it. Because, and if nothing else, Bristol City fans will know what, you know, bringing in some of his alumni from the Amex, they'll appreciate what it is that they've seen.
Yeah, I think so. We'll be looking at other players going out on loan next season, a la Ben White, a la Jason Malumbi, who've done really, really well.
Now we're talking to a central defender here, come striker, but let's not go down that road. You know, we've got Matt Clark and we've got Ben White to return to us next season. Who does that most put the writing on the wall for, assuming that these guys are going to be in Graham Potter's thoughts for next season, Adam?
I think Shane Duffy's in trouble. I don't know if he's the type of player that Graham can trust in terms of in a three and in a four. I think Ben's done exceptionally well this season for Leeds in terms of the way that he played, and he's got absolute plaudits, and he's the most spoken about championship player outside of the Premier League, which is real testament to him. There never seems to be any real concern that Lewis is ever going to leave.
I don't think he will.
You know, there never seems to be serious offers of 30, 40 million season after season, and the club are always in sort of jeopardy of losing him. You know, it seems it's well run by his agent. It seems it's well run by the football club that he's settled where he is, and it's almost like, if it's going to happen, the club are going to know about it and the club are going to have things in place. So I think Shane Duffy's going to be the one that's going to probably be looked out in terms of that. But then you've got Dan Byrne. He's played a lot of season at left back. You know, how will Graham see him as a centre-half trying to progress the club forward in terms of that?
Sure. Well, he can certainly. We know that Dan can certainly play a little bit.
Oh, but, of course, yeah.
Okay, well, we are running out of time. So quickly, Adam, you've had a bit of a gear crunch in your career as well. You're about to become an agent, I believe.
Good grief.
Yeah, I've tried everything else. I'll be an agent now to see
for
what
golf players, though, isn't it?
Say again?
For golfers.
Yeah, I've got in partnership with a golf agent, a guy called Ali Mellor, who set up Hype Golf Agency, and he wanted to go into football. So we had a couple of meetings before pre-lockdown, and you know, I gave the lowdown of what is expected of a football agent compared to a golf agent. And it is, to be honest, it's probably not the best time to set up a football agency in the pandemic, in terms of at the time meeting players and the financial budgets for teams next season. So you know, we're happy to do a slow process. You know, I've still got all my media commitments that I'm very much committed to. He's still got 10 or 12 golfers to look after. So it's just going to be a period of watching a lot of players, speaking to a lot of players and trying to go from there. But it's something I'm really, really excited about. It's a side of the game I love in terms of looking after players.
With that in mind then, Adam, I mean, you mentioned the economic situation that we're going to find ourselves in this coming window. I mean, how do you see the pandemic affecting transfers?
It's going to be difficult. We've spoken to clubs already that still don't know when they're even going back to pre-season in terms of when the players can come back in and when the players can go back to the start of the season. We're here in September the 12th for the Football League is going to be the return date for that. You know, clubs' budgets are going to be slashed quite a fair bit because it's the kind of after the furlough schemes of everything, it's then what can the business generate? And if you're not allowed fans into the ground, as we mentioned right at the start of the podcast, the revenue in terms of gate receipts, the revenue in terms of hospitality, the clubs can't go off that. So then they have to delve into their own pockets, and some clubs have got more money than others. I know League One are talking about a salary cap, but then teams like Portsmouth in that league will find it unfair that, like in the Premier League, a money advantage helps you win the league. So that's unfortunately the way that football is. But I think it's going to be a different summer from top to bottom. It's going to be cautious. Yeah. And then maybe in January, the signings that you see in August may happen in January because the sides wouldn't have a better idea of what's coming into the football club and what they can spend.
Okay. Well, the season finished with 91 clubs in the Football League. Hopefully it will restart with 92. We're seeing Barrow come back up into the Football League for the first time in many, many years. Obviously, that's a league which you watched a lot. I mean, that's good for them, isn't it? And hopefully, we're not going to see more clubs go to the wall.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen over the years, Hereford have gone all the way down to step nine and they're slowly working their way up. Darlington is another team that we lost, and Stockport was another one that we lost that have to really go down to the bottom of the financial difficulties and work their way back up.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, with that in mind, I mean, and you're looking at sort of players around and about, so I mean, sort of getting back to sort of who we're looking at. Not that we're actually sort of like going to accuse you of anything, but we're recording this on Thursday evening ahead of me going to Grimsby for the weekend. And the last time I was in Grimsby, we got relegated. Thankfully, we've actually undone that hoodoo. But what is it you're doing this evening, Adam, after this?
Well, I'm actually in a studio in London doing an Italian game, which is Lazio versus Cagliari in Serie A, which I've been doing now for the last month.
So you're going to have run the rule over any possible Albion signings for there?
Well, I saw one last week. I did Udinese against Lazio, funnily enough. And there's a player who's got a great name. And if he come to Brighton, he'd be fantastic. His name's Kevin Lasagna. And he's an Italian. He's an Italian international. And the reason he's called Kevin is because his dad is a big Kevin Costner fan. So his name's Kevin. And his surname is Lasagna. Yeah. He's a good player. I'll tell you, boys. He's certainly a very, very good player.
Beef up the attack, wouldn't he?
If you go on YouTube, he scored a goal against Sampdoria 2 weeks ago. On YouTube, and look at Kevin Lasagna. He scored 10 goals this season. He's an Italian international. He's got 10 goals for Udinese, who's sort of near the bottom of the league. I've sent one or two messages to one or two people.
On that note, I think we're past it. We're going to move on to a different layer now. So that's all we've got time for. Thanks very much to Adam Berger, of course, thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Aidy Packham. This has been the Albion Raw in association with oldfootballshirts.com on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com and podcast. We'll see you next week. I'm dancing on the White House lawn.